So looking at Luke 14, 1 to 14, and I've given it the title, In Christ Alone, My Hope is Found. If you read through the obituary columns of any local paper, like the County Times, and fairly often, you will come across something like this. John Brown died on the 8th of September after a long illness, bravely borne, now reunited with his dear wife, Anne. Reunited where? Well, the assumption, I think, is in heaven. A survey 3 years ago reported that a majority of British people still believe in heaven. And they are right to do so, for the Bible confirms the existence of heaven. So the key issue is not whether heaven exists. The key issue is who will go there. Most people have confidence that they will get there. Or at least their relatives have confidence that they will get there, judging by those obituaries. But is that confidence justified? Last week we saw how someone asked Jesus a question about how many people will get to heaven. Verse 23 of the last chapter, someone said to him, Lord, will those who are saved be few? And Jesus gave an answer that in effect was saying, look, that's not the right question. The question you need to be asking is not how many, but whether you will be going to heaven. Verse 24, strive to enter through the narrow door. For many, I tell you, will seek to enter and not be able. Because you see, there will be many people who are expecting to go there, but who discover that they aren't. So what is it that keeps people out of heaven? How can we be sure that we're going to get in? These are questions which run through this section of Luke's gospel. It's an issue which in the end of last chapter, this chapter and the next couple, Jesus looks at from various angles. It's such a vital subject because our eternal destiny quite literally depends on it. So Luke gives us a great deal of Jesus' teaching on this subject. And in this morning's passage, Jesus tells us of two things that will keep us out of heaven, but he also tells us how to get there. So I've got 3 points looking at, firstly at those two things, and thirdly how to get there. And the first thing that will keep us out of heaven, my first heading, self-righteousness will keep you out of heaven. Verses 1 to 6. The passage starts with an incident in the life of Jesus when he healed a man on a Sabbath day. Now, this is the third time this has happened in Luke's gospel. And all three episodes paint a similar picture. The first one, if you sort of keep your finger in chapter 14 and turn back to chapter 6, verses 6 following of chapter 6, we read, on another Sabbath, he entered the synagogue and was teaching, and a man was there whose right hand was withered. And the scribes and the Pharisees watched him to see whether he would heal on the Sabbath so that they might have a reason to accuse him. They want to see if he's going to break their rules about what you're allowed to do on the Sabbath and what you couldn't do. They've already decided against Jesus, and they want to find something that they can accuse him of. Well, if we read through that episode in chapter 6, we'll discover Jesus heals the man. He challenges their attitude, but their response, verse 11 of chapter 6, they were filled with fury and discussed with one another what they might do to Jesus. A couple of weeks back, beginning of chapter 13, there was another episode which revealed a very similar attitude on the part of the religious authorities. Again, Jesus heals, and their response, chapter 13, verse 14, the ruler of the synagogue were indignant because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath, said to the people, there are 6 days in which work ought to be done. Come on those days and be healed, and not on the Sabbath. So when we get to chapter 14, we know the score. We know what to expect. 14 verse 1, one Sabbath, when he went to dine at the house of a ruler, the house of a ruler of the Pharisees, they were watching him carefully. Not because they thought we might learn something from him, but watching him carefully because they thought, let's see if he does something wrong. Let's see if we can trap him. Let's see if we can find something against him. And we read verse 2, and behold, there was a man before him who had dropsy. It was probably a setup. You know, as we've seen, Jesus had a history of healing people on the Sabbath. A number of the Pharisees had seen him do this, but now they set him up in front of a ruler of the Pharisees, one of the top guys, so that he will have evidence for himself that Jesus breaks their religious rules. The symptoms of dropsy, which I think apparently is called edema now, are swollen limbs and swollen tissue resulting from excess body fluids. So it was a symptom of some other medical problem. Now, Jesus knows what is in the hearts of the Pharisees. He knows what these experts in the Jewish law are thinking. They're expecting him to heal the man. They're going to condemn him for doing it on the Sabbath. The guy could wait and be healed on Sunday, not Saturday. So Jesus directly challenges them about their beliefs. Verse 3, Jesus responded to the lawyers and the Pharisees saying, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not? Their response, but they remained silent. They can't defend their stance, but they're not willing to agree with Jesus. What does Jesus do? Jesus heals the man. We're told in the rest of verse 4, he takes him, he heals him, and he sends him away. Jesus has the power to heal the man instantly. He has the compassion to do it. He does it. And Jesus challenges them again. He said to them, verse 5, which of you, having a son or an ox that had fallen into a well on a Sabbath day, will not immediately pull him out? His choice of example is appropriate. A son or an ox falling into a well would obviously, you've got to do something quick because the boy or the animal's about to drown. So they would rush to haul him out. They had compassion on the boy. They had compassion on the ox. Or at least they're concerned about the value of the ox. Well, this poor man with dropsy was quite literally in danger of drowning in his own excess body fluids. So if compassion says, haul the boy out, or the ox out, surely compassion for this man justifies immediate action. Jesus' logic can't be refuted. We read verse 6, and they could not reply to these things. So why are these Pharisees so opposed to Jesus? That's what we need to look at. But before we look at that, can I appeal to you to listen? This isn't just a history lesson. This isn't just about some obscure group of people who lived 2,000 years ago, who've long since disappeared. This is all about us. We all face the temptation to be Pharisees. That's why there's so much about the Pharisees in the Gospels. It's not so that it's like a pantomime villain that you've got someone to boo. No, it's because the danger is that we are like them. So what was their problem? What can be our problem with Jesus? Well, Luke has already told us a lot about what Jesus did and said by the time, obviously, we get to chapter 14. And this is stuff that's in the public domain that everybody knows about. So the Pharisees knew that Jesus claimed to be the promised Messiah, the promised descendant of King David, who would set the world to rights. They knew that he had come and said to people, you must give up your rebellion against God. You must submit to God's authority, which means submitting to my authority, Jesus says, as God's appointed king in every area of your life. They knew that he had the authority, he claimed to have the authority, to forgive sins for people who trusted in him. They knew he was able to set people free from the devil. They knew he was able to heal. You see, Jesus not only made claims, he had presented his credentials. They'd heard the report of how when he was baptized, there was a voice from heaven saying, this is my beloved son. They could have done the research and found out that his family tree demonstrated he was descended from David. They had perhaps heard the story that he had personally triumphed over the desert when he'd been tempted severely for 40 days, which immediately set him apart from everyone else on the planet, because none of us here has ever resisted every temptation we've come across. And they knew that he had repeatedly cast out demons and healed the sick. He had not only presented great claims, he had shown his credentials. So why did the Pharisees oppose him? They knew his claims, they'd seen the evidence, they'd heard the evidence. Why didn't they come and say, Jesus, please forgive us? Jesus, become our king. The answer, and this is always the answer with Pharisees, is because they felt no need of his forgiveness. And they felt no need of his forgiveness because they had rejected God's rule over them. Now, they would have been totally astonished to hear anybody say of them that they had rejected God's rule over them. But why? The very thing they prided themselves on was the fact that they kept God's rules. We are the most moral people on the planet, they would have told you. We have the highest standard, we have the strictest rules. Yeah, but where do those rules come from? Are they God's rules or are they men's rules? Because you see, Jesus has just shown that they have no compassion. And God's rules, what are God's rules? Well, they're summarized as everybody knew by, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and mind and soul and strength, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. So if the rules you're observing result in no compassion, well, they're clearly not God's rules. So what had gone wrong? Well, God had given a very general rule in the Sabbath. It was simply, have a rest day once a week. But the trouble with that command for a Pharisee is, I want to be able to say, I've kept God's commands. I want to be able to tick a box and say, I've done it. And the command, just have a rest day once a week, that's too vague. It's not precise enough. For instance, when I get home on Saturday, can I cook lunch? Is that work or is that rest? And if I feel like going for a stroll after lunch, well, is that work or is that rest? And so the Pharisees had got to work on that very general command, just take a day of rest once a week, and they'd come up with very detailed rules. You must have a cold lunch that you prepared the day before, because to cook lunch on the Sabbath would be work. And you can go for a walk, but it must only be a certain distance. If you go beyond that, that's work. You know, we used to live in East London. There was a community up in Stamford Hill of ultra-Orthodox Jews, and you'd drive through there on the Saturday and you'd see them all out walking, because they can't drive the cars because that's work, but they'd have special poles which tell them how far you could walk, you know, what a Sabbath day's journey was. You see, the goal for all Pharisees is to be able to go away and say with confidence, I've kept the rule. Because being a Pharisee is all about self-righteousness. Be able to say, I've done it, I've kept the rules, I'm a very good person. I don't need forgiveness. Now, to achieve that, you have to replace God's all-encompassing rules with your own rules. And of course, then your rules then give you the right to oppress other people who don't keep your rules. Because after all, nothing is quite so helpful for feeling good about yourself as feeling bad about other people. And Phariseeism is alive and well in 21st century Britain. The key ingredients, just so you can spot Phariseeism in your own heart, because it's The Pharisee will be very good at spotting them in other people, but so you can spot them in your own heart, is ignoring God's rules to create your own, which are ones that you can keep pretty well, and then to get incensed by people who don't keep your rules. It's alive and well in most religious people, and I'm not just talking about non-Christian religions. I'm talking what passes as Christianity as well, who are far more interested in keeping their own rules and feeling good about themselves and feeling scandalized about other people than they are about seeking God's mercy, which they feel no need of. But you don't have to be religious to be a Pharisee. We see Pharisees, and wherever we keep God's rules with our own rules that we reckon we can keep, and then criticize others who don't keep the rules we've made. We had a perfect example of it from one of our political leaders in the last week, Nick Clegg. But the Lib Dems haven't got a monopoly on it. You know, when he referred to people who are opposing the plans to redefine marriage as bigots, that's me and you. Because you see, he's devised his own morality, which says anything goes in sexual morality, and then he feels qualified to criticize anyone who disagrees with his rules. But of course, he's not alone. The Prime Minister joins him. The leader of the Labour Party joins him. And such people feel no need of forgiveness. Years ago, when I was a teacher, I was teaching in a school that had a claim to fame. Eric Liddell had been there. It was a private school. Still had a chapel. We had chapel services every morning, though, because it had a religious foundation that was just history, really. But it was great. It meant as a teacher you could volunteer to take chapel. So I did once a term to take chapel for a week, and I just preached the gospel because it was supposed to be a Christian school. And I remember, and all the pupils were there, and as many of the teachers who wanted to be there were there. And I was obviously talking about our need for forgiveness one morning in school. And one of the other staff came up to me at the end, one of the English teachers. Absolutely incensed. He wasn't religious, but he was incensed. He said, "How dare you say I need forgiveness?" He wasn't religious, but he was a Pharisee. And such self-righteousness will keep you out of heaven, because we are all sinners. Those of us who are Pharisees, ancient or modern, are sinners just like the rest. We all need forgiveness. God's standards, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself, still stand. And our attempt to create our own rules are just a smokescreen to avoid facing up to the fact that we've broken God's rules. We all need forgiveness. And if we feel no need of forgiveness because we are self-righteous, that will keep us out of heaven. Self-righteousness will keep you out of heaven, but then secondly, so will self-promotion. Self-promotion will keep you out of heaven, verses 7 to 14. Now, what do I mean by self-promotion? Well, look at the situation, the first parable Jesus told us in verse 7. Now, he told a parable to those who were invited when he noticed how they chose the places of honor. It would seem then, as now, at social occasions, the most important places were those where you sat near the host. But there was a difference. In our day, at a dinner party, the host will tend to tell you, please sit here, I'd like you to sit there, and so on. But at their day at dinner parties, you were free to choose where you sat. You just came in and chose what you thought was the appropriate seat for someone of your social standing. Strangely enough, the seats that got filled first were the ones nearest the host, the places of honor. And that wasn't because the most important people always arrived first. It was rather that everybody, when they arrived, seemed to think they were pretty important, so they should have one of the best seats. And human nature hasn't changed in the last 2,000 years, has it? You see, it's the spirit of, I've got to push myself forward as much as possible. If I don't promote my own interests, who else is going to do it? It's a type of self-promotion or self-reliance. I've got to take matters into my own hands. Gilbert and Sullivan, a century or so ago, put it perfectly. They were probably tongue-in-cheek, but in one of their comic operas, if you wish in the world to advance, your merits you're bound to enhance. You must stir it and stump it and blow your own trumpet, or trust me, you haven't a chance. That's the spirit of our age. Spirit of every age. I've got to promote myself, because no one else will. So it's just a small thing where I choose to sit at a dinner party. But it's these small things that show what is going on deep down inside us. So Jesus tells a parable about a familiar social problem because our actions in these little situations reveal a massive spiritual issue. Verses 8 and 9. When you're invited by someone to a wedding feast, do not sit down in a place of honor, lest someone more distinguished than you be invited by him. And he who invited you both will come and say to you, give your place to this person, and then you'll begin with shame to take the lowest place. Probably virtually all of us have been there, haven't we? We've been invited to a wedding reception. But normally, in our day, you go and there's a seating plan, and you look up on the little plan, oh, right, that's who I've got to sit next to for the next 3 hours, and you go and find the appropriate seat. But if they didn't have a seating plan, where would you choose to sit yourself when you turned up at the wedding? Well, say you come in and you put yourself somewhere pretty high up. Say you put yourself on the top table. Look, I'm pretty important. I used to play football with the groom when we were at primary school together. So I'm clearly one of the most important people here. I should be on the top table. So you sit there and the place fills up and you think, everybody's looking at me, saying, oh, he's one of the honored guests. He's on the top table. And then the bride's father comes up and taps you on the shoulder, accompanied by someone else. And you look round and, oh, the Prime Minister's there. He happens to be a long-standing family friend. And the fact that you played football with the groom at primary school doesn't quite seem so important now. And he says, excuse me, could you move, please? And you look around and the only seat left now is over there in the far corner by where the waiters come out from the kitchen. Now, Jesus says humility, even down here, is verse 10. When you're invited, go and sit at the lowest place. So the host comes in and says, come, you shouldn't be sitting there. Come up higher. You know, even down here, that is wisdom. Well, Jesus is saying, look, if we recognize that down here, why don't we do it? Because there is within each of us that sense of self-reliance, that sense of insecurity, that sense of, I must put myself forward, because if I don't do it, nobody else is going to. And Jesus says, such self-promotion will keep you out of heaven. Verse 11, for everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. If you try and push yourself forward, if that's your attitude in life, that I must blow my own trumpet, that actually reveals something deep down inside us. If we apply that same approach to spiritual matters, God, I really deserve a place in heaven. I've been a thoroughly decent person. Then Jesus says that will keep you out of heaven. For you don't deserve a place there. I don't deserve a place there. We are not that good. So self-promotion will keep you from heaven. That's looking at it from the point of view of the person invited to the feast. Look at it from the angle of the person issuing the invitations now, Jesus says. Verse 12. He said also to the man who had invited him, when you give a dinner or a banquet, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or rich neighbors, lest they also invite you in return and you be repaid. If you want to grasp the idea here, it may be helpful to substitute the parable of the banquet with the parable of the Christmas card and Christmas present list. in a couple of months, we will all have to go through that major social nightmare, which is making our Christmas card lists, and also deciding who we're going to give a present to and how much we're going to spend on that present. And I can almost guarantee that you will have the following conversation at some point, either with your husband or wife or with yourself. It will go like this. Well, I'm not going to send a card to her. She didn't send one to us last year. Or you'll be sitting there looking at the present list and think, oh my goodness, they sent us such and such last year, and it must have cost a packet. That was really embarrassing because we only sent them a pair of socks. We'd better send something a lot better this year. We'll all do it. Now listen again to verse 12. He said to the man who had invited him, when you give a dinner or a banquet, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or your neighbors, lest they also invite you in return and you be repaid. See, it's all about self-promotion. It's like the girl who wants to invite the most popular girl in her class to her birthday party. Because she reasons, if I invite her to my birthday party, then she will feel obliged to invite me back. And that will make me look good. Because if I'm invited to the house of the most popular girl in the class, then people will think I'm important. At least that's how it worked 30 years ago when I was at school, and I don't think it's changed since. It's about giving to people, not because we want to give them a gift, but because of what we expect they will do for us in return. It's all about an attitude of self-promotion. And Jesus says self-promotion will keep you out of heaven. You'll be repaid when they invite you back, all right. But that is all the repayment you will get. There's a great verse in the Sermon on the Mount, which is on exactly the same theme. Matthew 6:2. Thus, when you give to the needy, sound no trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may be praised by others. Truly I say to you, they have received their reward. They're not going to get anything from God. They've already received the reward they're going to get. I once was listening to a minister who ended up on a committee at a cathedral. And the committee at this cathedral was about, there'd been lots of quite wealthy donors who'd given a lot to the cathedral, you know, to keep it in good repair. And these people were sitting around were thinking, they'll want some recognition for that. What shall we do about it? And they were discussing about putting up a plaque to list, you know, people who'd given a lot to the cathedral. And they felt, well, the thing is, it's a cathedral. It'd be good if we put some Bible text on it. What Bible text do you think we should put on this plaque? And this minister I knew suggested, well, what about Matthew 6, verse 2? Truly I say to you, they have received their reward. And he said, strangely enough, his suggestion wasn't taken up by the other members of the committee. But he was spot on. They had received their reward. They were doing it for self-promotion. It's not just giving to cathedrals. Why do we have photographs in local papers of people with huge charity checks standing by? Well, it's usually an ambulance. It's usually the air ambulance, isn't it? Self-promotion. Jesus' alternate strategy is verse 13. But when you give a feast, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind. The point is that if you give, simply give to be generous, with no chance of repayment, let alone hope of repayment or expectation of repayment. You know, when you do that, you see, you've said goodbye to self-promotion. In fact, the only hope left for you then is that God promotes you. Verse 14, and you will be blessed, because they cannot repay you, will be repaid at the resurrection of the just. See, the issue is, who are you relying on to get you to heaven? Both these points are saying the same thing, really. Are you relying on yourself? Constructing a righteousness for yourself. Promoting yourself, putting your case forward. You know, polishing up your CV so that when you get there before God and he interviews you, God, I really think you should give me the job because.
Are you relying on yourself? Well, what's the alternative? Is there some other way? Well, thirdly and finally, in Christ alone, my hope is found. See, the negative message of this passage, what will keep you out of heaven, is self-righteousness, self-promotion, which are both forms of self-reliance. And so is despair. Despair is a form of self-reliance, isn't it? Because if you're despairing, you're just saying, oh no, I'm not good enough. I've got to get myself there. Forget it. The positive message of this passage is that if we give up relying on ourselves, give up promoting ourselves, give up constructing our own righteousness, and rely instead on God's mercy and God's grace in Christ, if we do that, then heaven is certain. But Jesus said, verse 11, everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. So give up on righteousness, self-righteousness. I'm simply not good enough for heaven, and nor are you. God demands perfect love for him and perfect love for those around us. And you and I can't do that. My only hope is the mercy of God to give me a righteousness that I don't have myself. And you are in exactly the same boat as me. So that is your only hope. So give up on self promotion. God must promote me. God must promote you. What he's called for is humility. Recognizing that I've got nothing to offer. For the mercy and righteousness and promotion given by God are promised to those who humbly come and rely on Christ. Verse 11, for everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. George Herbert, who was a poet born in Montgomery 400 years ago, put it very simply and very well. Humble we must be if to heaven we go. High is the roof there, but the gate is low. Humble we must be if to heaven we go. High is the roof there, but the gate is low. And a heart that is relying on God's grace and mercy in Christ, that has given up trying to manufacture its own righteousness and promote its own cause, will reveal itself in outward acts of humility and generosity. Verse 14. For it will invite the poor and the needy. It will be generous to others. And will be repaid at the resurrection of the just. So I ask you as I close, have you seen that you have nothing to commend yourself to God, that there is nothing you can possibly do to make yourself acceptable to God, and that the only way to get to heaven is to humble yourself and to totally rely on Christ? And has that shown itself outwardly in your humble generosity to others?